It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Did you know one quarter of all vegetables eaten in America are French fries? Well, despite that, one expert thinks the obesity tide is turning. Today, it's Food Fight with Dr. Kelly Brownell, director of the Yale Center for Eating and Weight Disorders, a man who sees hope on the horizon. The Stearns discover a secret source for dynamite chili. It's a grocery store in Topeka, Kansas. Sally Schneider talks sneaky cooking, healthy ways with bacon. We've got a new way to bring the family together, cook for the dog, and we get the latest from Vogue magazine. Would you believe status mints? All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's Food Fight with Dr. Kelly Brownell, director of the Yale Center for Eating and Weight Disorders. With all the bad news on weight, he looks at some of the victories in our battle with obesity. Healthy cook Sally Schneider comes to the rescue of all bacon lovers. The author of The Orchid Thief unveils her newest muses, her pup and his food dish. Then we get the latest from Vogue magazine. Would you believe status mints? And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll now with the Stearns, Jane and Michael. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane. Hey, Michael. Good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
So where have you been?
We've been in Topeka, Kansas, and it's a good thing we were there this time of year because in the cold weather months in Topeka, Porubsky's Grocery serves chili, and this is one of the great dining experiences of the heartland.
One of the great things about Porubsky's, and I have to admit I have a certain... oh, my God, a certain heartfelt thing for whenever you go into a restaurant or a little grocery store and there's just a tiny four-burner stove from the 1950s, like, you know, anybody who lives in a small apartment in Manhattan would have. And this is where they do all their cooking. There's nothing grand and, you know, garland stove and restaurant-y about it. It's a little home stove with a couple of little pots on it, and that's where they make their world-famous chili.
Well, in fact, when Jane says that's where they do all their cooking is chili. That's the menu.
So is this a grocery store or is it a restaurant?
This is so much a grocery store that, in fact, it serves only lunch. And it serves only lunch Monday through Thursday because the proprietors, the Porubsky family, feels that they need to keep the aisles clear on Friday so people can do their weekend shopping. So you can't go there on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday to eat because it is strictly for grocery shoppers.
And it is such a small town place that I just realized when I said like an apartment dweller in Manhattan would have, when Michael and I were at Porubsky's, people asked me where I was from and I said Manhattan, meaning Manhattan, New York.
Right.
And everybody said, oh, Manhattan, Kansas, I've been there. So it's a real Kansas experience.
The great thing about this place, in addition to the fact that the chili is wonderful, is that they serve it with a condiment I've never seen before anywhere, and that is Porubsky's homemade horseradish pickles. Now, this sounds like sort of an odd thing to go with chili, but believe me, it works. They take these dill pickles, and they somehow sort of marinate them in this really ferocious horseradish sauce. So they're, I mean, hotter than jalapenos, and you sort of dot your chili with these horseradish pickles, and it makes it an extraordinary eating experience.
And it's a very quirky place, like all of our favorite road food places are. They don't serve coffee because they want you to get the hell out of there fast. You're not allowed to eat and linger. It's here's your chili and go.
What kind of chili is this? I mean, what is it like?
It's real Midwestern chili, meaning that a person from Texas wouldn't recognize it as chili.
It's a tomato-based ground beef, mild spices. The garlic horseradish pickles really give it that extra oomph. But it's delicious. It truly does taste like mom. It's a mom and pop place and tastes like mom made it. The area that Porubsky's in used to be called Little Russia. It was a small ethnic enclave. And the place still does have that very kind of ethnic neighborhood feel to it.
And so, of course, you get sort of Russian-based chili in Topeka, Kansas. I think this makes great sense. Guys, thank
you. Makes sense to me. Bye-bye,
Lynn. Just don't ask for coffee.
Okay.
Bring your own.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need way over in a bucket seat.
The Stearns are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Boy, is this ever chilly weather. We've been working on dropping holiday excess, and we improvised this kind of vegetable chili. It's actually sort of South Beach meets Atkins. Anyway, it's spicy, filling, low-cal, and it's really good to have stashed in the fridge. You take about a pound each of cabbage and green beans. You brown them in a big skillet with onion and a little olive oil. And then you add lots of garlic. You take your favorite chili powder, or if you're purist, you mix up some pure ground chili with cumin and coriander and oregano. Anyway, you sprinkle that in, and then I always throw in some dried basil and sweet paprika. And you cook that just a minute. You kind of want to toast those spices. And now the real secret. You add a little vinegar and you add a little wine. And you cook that down while you scrape up all the brown stuff in the bottom of the pan. Throw in some tomatoes, cook everything until it's tender, and you're there. Now you can get the recipe, Lynn's Winter Veggie Chili, on the website, splendidtable.org. I don't know about you, but I've hit the wall. After weeks of glorious excess, I think it's time to stop. Now, the problem is, no way do I want to give up the goodness of excess. Well, this is a job for Sally Schneider, our resident expert on how to eat healthier without giving up flavor. Now, she's the author of A New Way to Cook, for once a title that is not an exaggeration. Sally, good to talk to you again.
Hello, Lynn.
Okay, we've been on a bacon kick lately, so is it time? I mean, do I have to give it up?
Lynn, if you're with me, a pure hedonist, you cannot give up something so delicious. Life is not worth living. We have to figure out how to have our bacon and eat it too, which I have, and that's what I'm going to talk about.
Okay, all right, so how do I have my bacon and eat it too? I knew you were going to say that. I'm so glad to hear that.
You can count on me. First of all, when we're talking about bacon, I like to include also pancetta, which is the Italian version of bacon, that is cured belly meat, but the pancetta is not smoked like our bacon. And there's another delicious thing that's coming down the line these days called guanciale, which is the succulent flesh from the hog's jowl that is cured also like pancetta. And these three cured pork products are just divine flavorings for a host of foods.
Sally, before we get to flavoring, how should we buy these things? Because, for instance, I know in bacon, there's great bacon and there's not so great bacon.
Exactly. Well, like anything, it may take some seeking out. There are really good bacons and pancetta in more upscale or gourmet-oriented stores these days. There's also fantastic products online, for example, through Nyman Ranch. So you say, well, what if I need it, you know, in a pinch? I can't go running out to some fancy store. What I do is I buy, say, a pound at a time, and then I divide it up into 1.5 or 2 ounce portions, wrap it in plastic wrap, and freeze it.
Mm-hmm.
It freezes wonderfully. It freezes indefinitely. And then I can just pull out what I need for cooking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. But now let's get to this issue of how you use them without, you know, adding to the excess.
Well, the trick really is to render out some of the fat. Rendering means that you cook the bacon or pancetta slowly in a pan until the fat liquefies and separates from the lean flesh, which crisps. All you do is chop up or dice the pancetta or bacon. I figure about 1.5 ounces will do 4 servings. You put it in a heavy nonstick skillet, cover it, and cook it over low heat, stirring it occasionally, probably about 7 or 8 minutes, until you see that the fat is liquid and the meat is crisp and brown. Then what I do is I pour off the fat, which I'll then spoon in by the teaspoon as much as I want for the recipe. You can leave the crisp pieces in the pan, or you can scoop them out with a slotted spoon to reserve as a garnish. So that's your base. You can use that for making stews, for sautéing onions. I love it for sautéing or braising all manner of vegetables. Root vegetables like parsnip, celery, turnips. Spinach is great with these pork products. Dandelion greens, cabbage, string beans, asparagus, sugar snap peas, broccoli. And artichoke hearts are fabulous this way.
In short, if it grows, you can do this with it, right?
Well, especially with pancetta, which doesn't have a smoky flavor, and it's like a truffle. It makes everything taste better. So,
and so much cheaper. But where would you use bacon as opposed to pancetta, for instance?
I love bacon for its smoke flavor. It's basically the same stuff, but it's been smoked. So beans, for example, love a smoky flavor. Delicate meats, I would prefer pancetta because if I'm doing a pheasant, say, I don't want to obscure its flavor. But a pork roast might be wonderful with strips of bacon put over it, which will make it more succulent and so on. Bacon and smoke actually go with practically all the things that I named pancetta goes with. It's really a matter of taste and style and what you want to achieve in your recipe. And I just want to leave you with one of my favorite simple ways to use any of these products, and that is to make a hash of root vegetables in a skillet. You render the guanciale or pancetta, whatever, the way I said,
right,
and throw in tossed celery root, rutabaga, and parsnips, add a little water, cover the pan. The root vegetables will braise, and when the liquid evaporates, you can then fry them in the residual fat, and they'll get crispy. It is delicious.
Okay, this sounds like, and I'm not going to give up a lot. Thank you, Sally.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, we've put Sally's recipe for roasted root vegetable hash on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're roaming the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Now, every week we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique and shopping tips, and best of all, it's free. So sign up on the website, guys, splendidtable.org. Coming up, food fight, winning the battle with obesity, cooking for the pup, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Want to make $1 million? Come up with a new diet book. Everybody talks about weight. We have never been so weight and health conscious, and we have never been so fat. 65% of us are obese. To put it another way, right now, 1/4 of all vegetables eaten in the United States are French fries. One scientist who has been working to turn the tide on the obesity problem is Professor Kelly Brownell. He is director of the Yale Center for Eating and Weight Disorders, and he's author of the book Food Fight, The Inside Story of the Food Industry, America's Obesity Crisis, and What We Can Do About It. Dr. Brownell, welcome back to the Splendid Table.
It's always nice to be on this show.
Kelly, you've talked to us several times about this problem, and you're one of the people who's really taken the food industry to task. Now look, we're seeing Ruffles with no trans fat. I mean, do you think there's a positive trend here?
The obesity crisis is caused by many factors. The behavior of the food industry is only one of the contributors, but certainly an important one. When the food industry makes changes, I think we should be open-minded and not be not let them off the hook for the bad things they're doing, but also not be overly skeptical and assume bad motives when they're introducing healthier foods. So I'm of the mind where we celebrate the positive changes that are being made, but also keep the food industry accountable for the bad things it's doing. So, for example, if McDonald's puts yogurt on its menu, which they have, I think that's a good thing, and they should be reinforced for that. But that doesn't mean that the relentless advertising they do to kids should be ignored. So we need to hold them accountable.
You know, but the big thing here is, though, the food industry or any other industry, their mission is to make money. I mean, should they have to take responsibility for our health?
They can be encouraged to do that by the consumers requesting different kinds of foods, or to some extent, they can be forced to do that by the government. For example, the food industry, the restaurant industry right now is fighting viciously against legislation to provide calorie values on menus at chain restaurants. Well, of course, they don't want people to know how many calories are in those foods because they would fall over in a dead faint knowing that they, yeah, they get so many calories or so many grams of saturated fat in a single meal. Well, too bad.
Mm-hmm.
People
mm-hmm.
have to know that, and that legislation has to go through. So the industry, I think, is going to have to be forced to do some of the things.
What about what's happening in schools in terms of fast foods that are being used in school cafeterias? Have you seen any changes there?
The schools have become an unsafe nutrition environment. Most schools have vending machines galore. They're selling soft drinks and fast foods and making money from it. There are many examples of the food environment gone wrong in schools. In fact, most of us adults wouldn't recognize the food environment in a school because it's much different than the way it was when we were children. But there's good reason to be optimistic. A number of changes are occurring in school districts around the country where they're making the food environment a more safe one. The most notable example is the Unified School District of Los Angeles, which has essentially kicked out the soft drinks. And they have some 700,000 children in those schools. That's an important move because children will be screened from those inducements to have soft drinks during school hours, but also because it makes a very important symbolic statement to the community and parents that kids are having too many soft drinks.
But isn't this going against some very powerful forces in the sense that the more you sell, well, the more profitable you are? And a school that does not have that food in the cafeteria may be losing a great deal of income. And in this particular environment, that could be devastating.
The schools have been surprised to find that when they get rid of the unhealthy foods, like the soft drinks and the machines, that they experience an immediate drop off in income. But then it tends to bounce back if they replace the unhealthy choices with healthier ones. But you're right, essentially, there are very powerful economic forces that are fighting against these changes. The food industry is massively powerful. There's a long history of them affecting public policy in Washington, and it's still happening. That's exactly why the most dramatic actions being taken against the obesity crisis are happening at the local and state levels, not in Washington.
Is there anything the individual can do?
We can be very effective as advocates by working through institutions locally like schools. Parents going to a school board meeting or talking to the principal or working with the PTA to try to rid the schools of the snack foods and the soft drinks and machines have been effective time and time again around the country. Parents can write to a company like Disney or Nickelodeon and ask that those characters not be licensed to companies selling sugary snack foods to kids. Mm-hmm. There are a number of things parents can do that can be very powerful.
Kelly, one of the solutions you mentioned is think differently. What do you mean?
There's been a mindset change in our country, unlike any I've ever seen, about the problem of obesity. It's mirrored in what you see in the press and the media. If you go back 4 or 5 years, nearly every article you would have seen was on how to lose weight. That is an indication of this, the society's idea that weight is the fault of the individual and all they need is help in changing their behavior. Now, most of the articles one sees are about obesity as a public health issue. That is, why is our culture becoming overweight and what are those environmental forces that are making that happen? If we think about obesity as a public health issue, then we start looking at the causes at the level of the population. That is what's making us a heavy country. Mm-hmm. And that leads us right to protecting our children. It leads us to preventing this problem rather than trying to treat it. And it leads to thinking about big, broad environmental changes that will create an environment where it's easy for people to lead healthy lives.
Well, Dr. Kelly Brownell, thank you.
Thank you.
Kelly Brownell is director of the Yale Center for Eating and Weight Disorders. His book is Food Fight, the inside story of the food industry, America's obesity crisis, and what we can do about it. Of course, obesity isn't the whole picture of American food. American food is, well, it's an attitude. So what happens when you take that American attitude abroad? Well, sometimes what looks like freedom from the outside is quite different once you get inside. College freshman Jesse Chanin has a story to tell.
I will compare it neither to the Last Supper nor to an inmate's final meal before execution, but still the family dinner the night before I left to spend 9 months on a high school exchange was infused with a sort of giddy gravity. We decided to eat out, and I chose Friendly's as a joke. Typical American food, I quipped, wiping the oil off French fries. And in a way, as the middle-aged waitress leaned forward with her grungy and revealing blouse to pick up the dishes, it represented everything I was escaping from. The drudgery, the routine, the mediocrity of suburban middle-class life. I was going to have an adventure. I was leaving home. I was going to Spain. At 9 o'clock the next morning, I'd be an independent person. Several days later, I found myself nervously and surreally waiting to be picked up by the exchange family I'd never met. They sounded very decent. A mother, a girl my age, a few older brothers, and they'd had exchange students before. Perfect. In fact, everything thus far seemed perfect. The teary airport departure, the 2-day orientation with 7 other students, all of us so alive with our optimism and expectations, all of us so wonderfully young, walking around alone in Madrid through gorgeous European plazas, and then returning to the hotel for interminable meals of paella, soups, Spanish puddings, and then released back upon the town, upon Europe. It was all I'd imagined. My host mother drove up in an SUV. We didn't talk at all during the 40-minute drive home. Upon my arrival, 2 women who spoke neither Spanish nor English cooked eggs in the microwave for me, and we ate together. They turned out to be illegal Romanian immigrants working on slaves' wages in the attic. And thus my schedule was established. As my antipathy toward the family increased, I began to resent their food as well. I didn't want to be under their control. I wanted to come home and choose my food, to open the fridge and make myself a sandwich, and not eat chicken soup if I didn't feel like it, to rebel. 5 months after I arrived, my program acknowledged my request for a switch and found me another host family, all the way across the country. I went with a bit of trepidation, anticipating the change, but dreading having to start everything all over again. I'd talked to my new host mother on the phone, and she'd sounded worryingly Spanish. A 60-year-old woman living alone. She'll love to take you to museums, my rep told me. She greeted me with a bowl of spaghetti. Though at first I adapted to the established pace of the household, later, since the woman was cooking just for me, I unsuccessfully tried to mold it to my tastes. Can we eat a bit earlier than 3? I suggested one day. No, she said. You're so American. In all aspects of my life, she never failed to observe. I was so American. I was shabby. I cleaned like an American, which is to say, badly. I thought like an American. I had no appreciation for other cultures. And now I wanted to eat like an American, too? No, ma'am, not in her home. I avoided the kitchen, and as an extension, the house itself, and daydreamed about true freedom and independence, the refrigerator at home. A week ago, with much personal congratulation, I arrived back in Maine. The patriotic gas station signs still strike me as disturbingly absurd, but I ate chocolate cake for breakfast this morning, and any culture where you can make veggie burgers and bagel sandwiches on the merest whim shouldn't be dismissed too quickly. It seems silly to say that after a year in an exotic, romantic country, I'm so pleased to be in suburban Portland. But everyone does speak English, and besides, the ice cream in Spain is a national disgrace.
Writer Jesse Chanin is a college freshman in New York City. Susan Orlean is the author of the bestseller, The Orchid Thief, the book that became the movie adaptation. Now, this, by the way, is not an autobiographical work. Susan has not spent years sniffing nefarious substances in the bayous. Instead, she's been at work on another kind of book. It's a cookbook, and it has the most endearing cover shot of a spaniel. It's called Throw Me a Bone by Cooper Gillespie. Susan, welcome.
Great to be here.
So, Susan, what's the connection between you and Cooper Gillespie?
Well, I would have to say, besides being his typist, he's my boss in a way.
Uh-huh.
He's my dog.
he's the cover animal.
he's the cover boy and the inspiration for the book Throw Me a Bone. He's also the very enthusiastic taste tester for many of the recipes in the book.
So you're writing a cookbook for a dog. Now, how does a novelist who has gone from writing about orchids go to writing a cookbook for a dog?
It's a leap, that's for sure. But this was a project that I did between finishing The Orchid Thief and starting work on a new book. This was so much fun, I have to tell you. It also satisfied my curiosity about dog nutrition. You know, it's very funny. When he was a puppy, he had an upset stomach one day, and my vet said, well, give him lamb and rice for a week or two. And I thought, well, how do I make lamb and rice for a dog? And she said, well, you can buy it canned. Mm-hmm. So I did, and it was ridiculously expensive. And one day I was looking at the ingredients on the can, and it said lamb and rice. And I thought, all right, I think I can do that. And I was working with the trainer at the time just to teach Cooper a few manners. And she was an advocate of cooking for your dogs. And I said to her one day, well, Stacy, look, I don't even cook for myself. And she said, that's okay. I don't cook for myself either, but I cook for the dogs.
Now, that's an interesting point. I mean, I was thinking we're living in a time when nobody has time to cook, and you're writing a cookbook that's saying cook for your dog. So what's the draw here?
The thing about cooking for a dog is it's the way cooking used to be before we all became so neurotic and nervous about human health. You know, now when I cook for myself, I'm thinking, all right, am I carbo loading here, or is this Atkins friendly, or is this too yeah. many calories, mm-hmm. or is this going to look good on the plate? Do I have a balanced meal? Cooking for your dog is sort of liberating because you do it without all of the anxiety that we seem to bring to cooking for humans. I always imagine this would be something great to do with kids, to make dog biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that way you can cook with your kid and you're not required to eat what your kid comes up with. And I know for a lot of parents, this is a very, very exciting prospect.
Well, tell me something. One question. Can you feed table scraps to your dog?
No, you really should not. And there are a bunch of reasons for this. First of all, what we find palatable as people is specifically not what dogs should eat. We like salt. We like spices. We like sugar. We like oil. Those are things that dogs shouldn't have. We also eat certain things that dogs specifically can't have, like chocolate, which is poisonous for dogs. Grapes and raisins, strangely enough, are poisonous for dogs.
Huh.
So you don't want to be scraping what's left over on your plate into your dog's dish. I also think it's a bad habit to cultivate because your dog's going to make the connection and you're going to end up with a dog who's going to beg. And I hate that. I don't like Cooper to sit at the table and stare at me with that look of, you know, I'm really hungry and what you're having looks really good.
Well, Susan, thank you. And I've now discovered my favorite pinup pet. Thanks a lot.
He'll be happy to hear it. Thank you.
Novelist Susan Orlean is the typist for Throw Me a Bone. Now, the book's author, Cooper Gillespie, was kind enough to leave us with a recipe. Goldie's Meatloaf Cupcakes Frosted with Mashed Potatoes. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, guys, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Which countess has a teapot named for her? And we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, which countess has a teapot named for her? Well, it was the British Countess Cadogan, who lived in the 1700s. The Cadogan teapot was a puzzle pot. It was a great conversation piece, and now it's a great collector's item. The mystery was how it worked, because you filled it from the bottom. There was no top lid. Now, once upright, the only place for the tea to escape was through the spout. The trick here was there was a long tube that ran from the hole in the bottom of the teapot almost to the top of the inside of the pot. So once you flip the pot upright, there were no leaks. The story behind the teapot is that evidently it was copied from a Chinese pot that came to the Cadogan family in the 1700s. Now, they lived in the middle of England's pottery district, so the pot was copied and eventually became a hot trend. Now, you can have your very own Cadogan teapot. A Chinese original from the 1600s is selling right at this moment on the web for just about $9,000. But there is a bargain out there. You can buy an English original for a mere $2,500. The lines are officially open. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. Beverly is on the phone from Saginaw. It's Saginaw, Michigan, right, Beverly?
That's correct.
I finally got it right. What do you want to talk about?
Actually, I had an opportunity to go to Bolivia last year, and while I was there, I was served peanut soup. And I'm calling about, for some reason I thought it was a soup that was just from there, but looking through my recipe books, I see it different places. But this had chicken in it, and I was just calling to find out your view on the various varieties
of peanut soup. Well, I'd love to know the flavoring you had in it.
It was, it had a broth.
Right.
I think probably either chicken or beef.
And was it spicy? Was it
just a little bit?
A little bit. And were the peanuts whole? Were they crushed?
There was actually I didn't even see the peanuts.
They maybe had been crushed into a peanut butter sort of mixture.
I think so.
Well, you know, one of the things I always associate peanut soup with is Africa. And I do know, and you know, not that I've been there, but I browse cookbooks the way, you know, people read fashion magazines,
right,
or whatever. And there's very little written about the foods of Africa, but I am remembering a book that the name escapes me, but I remember this woman broke it down by different countries, and Zimbabwe had a peanut soup that was done with broth and peanut butter, if I remember. I think it had chicken in it. It had some chili in it, and it had onion and it had garlic. But what was really interesting was a note saying that typically it's made from dried vegetables. So that's what I'm thinking of as peanut soups.
Okay.
But, and I think in the South people add cream. Now we're going to probably get a flood of responses from listeners. If you look, there's a book by Jessica Harris. And I cannot remember the name of it. I think I want to say it's Wooden Spoons and Iron Pots, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
That is about Africa. She's a wonderful historian and food writer. And then there's another book called The Africa News Cookbook. Two interesting sources for you.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to go to Bolivia to eat. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We've got Ron calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Ron, how are you? Good. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I got a case of the glutinous mashed potatoes that I need to solve.
Wallpaper paste. I know what you're talking about.
Exactly. And I think I'm doing everything right, but my wife continues to have doubts about it.
Explain what you're doing.
So I usually chunk the potatoes and peel them.
Right.
Boil them in water, and that may be the first problem. I don't know how long they should be boiled for. Maybe I'm boiling them too long. But
right.
Then I drain them. I actually do a second step of heating them back on the burner. I've been told that's a good way of drying them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I take the masher, because I don't use a ricer or a food mill, and I use an old-fashioned masher.
Right.
And I start mashing, and then once I've got them mashed a little, I add butter by the tablespoon, and then I'll add heated milk. And I'll switch over to a wooden spoon at some point when I feel I've mashed them enough. And at that point, they start to get thick and that gluey.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. What kind of potato are you using?
Well, generally russets and or red potatoes.
Okay. The red potatoes tend to be what we call boiling potatoes, and they tend to have less starch and be more waxy, whereas the russet or the Bakers, the Idahos, whatever you want to call them, tend to have more starch, which has more chance of getting gluteny, you know, getting sticky and gluey. But I think you're overmixing. I think the key is, I think a masher is just swell, but the key is don't overwork it. I use a ricer. One of the nice things about a ricer is it breaks up the potato without stirring it in any way.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a great way to do it. And, of course, I use heavy cream, but we don't have to go there, Ron.
No, trying to cut down some of those.
I know. Hey, but, Ron, thanks, because I have a feeling there are a lot of people out there with this problem.
Yes. I know everybody's favorite food is mashed potatoes.
You got it.
Not the easiest thing to make right.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Bye now.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Just FYI, my favorite potato for mashed potatoes is either the Yukon Gold or the Yellowfins or the Redskins. I'm not a baker lover. Anyway, we've got Joan on the line from Hillsboro, Oregon. Hey, Joan, what's up? What's happening?
Oh, hi, Lynn. I was just traveling on the East Coast, and I was looking forward to the best lobster I ever had, but then I'm not sure. And so my question is there a warm water lobster and cold water lobster?
Well, there kind of is. Now, this is where I'm putting on my science hat. Now, let me think for a minute. Yeah, there are warm water lobsters, but they're not, from my knowledge, true lobsters. They're sort of a member of a family that's close to the lobster. And I think they're called spiny lobsters, and that's where you get those lobster tails that come in the freezer case.
That are small.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like the lobster really doesn't have big claws, but it has a big tail.
Huh.
Now, what did the lobster taste like on the East Coast? Was it great?
No. Well, I think it was prepared badly. It was all watery.
What time of year was this?
Last month.
All right. So it was winter.
Yes.
I think it was prepared badly then. Because there's a time, like in the summer, is when the lobsters change shells,
uh-huh.
from what I understand. And at that time, they can tend to be watery.
Uh-huh.
And at this time of year is usually in the winter, the fall and winter is usually a time when the lobsters are really in their prime.
Uh-huh.
But you trust your taste. If you don't think that this was a great lobster, it wasn't a great lobster. That's it. There's a couple of things. There's something you should look at. There's a wonderful book out there by a chef named Jasper White.
Uh-huh.
And it came out several years ago, and I think it's called something like Lobster or Lobster at Home. This man has probably cooked more lobsters, he's in New England, than any other chef in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And take a look at it, because there is a lobster calendar that tells you when to buy the lobster and when the best buys are. There's also a whole discussion of where lobster comes from. And I think that would be and it's one of those books, if it's in the library, take a look at it. Or you might find it in a secondhand store. I'm not sure if it's still in print. It came out several years ago.
Well, that's a great tip.
Yeah, and a big lobster isn't necessarily a great lobster, by the way.
Oh, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, a big lobster can be a mite chewy. And, you know, it takes about 5 years for a lobster to get to be edible size. Yeah, so you're talking about a really old lobster. But if you go for about a 2-pound lobster, that's generally prime eating size.
Okay.
Hey, thanks a lot, Joan.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Reach us, 800-537-5252. There is nothing better than a steamed lobster. We've got Scott calling from Portland, Oregon. Hey, Scott, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hello, Lynn. Well, I'm moving from Portland to the Dalles, which is about 60 miles away. I have an edible garden right now with grapes and potatoes and mint.
Oh, Lord, that sounds wonderful.
I've even got a eucalyptus tree, but I don't think you can eat anything from there.
No, in fact, pretty dangerous to do those leaves.
No, but it smells wonderful.
Mm.
Well, anyway, I'm going to be moving into a condominium, and so I'm not going to have a garden anymore. And I know that there is resources out there for growing plants in pots.
Now, uh-huh.
I certainly know my herbs. I'll be doing sage and basil and rosemary, tarragon.
Right.
But I don't know what I can do in pots. I've got this enormous patio out back, and it's an agricultural community that I'm moving into, about 12,000 people.
Uh-huh.
But they are known as Little Arizona in a state of state which is famous for rain, it only gets about 12 inches of rain a year.
So Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing. You're reminding me of my days of living in Colorado because it's very dry. And I'll tell you one herb that does brilliantly in a climate like that, and that's lavender.
Oh, good.
Well, if you think about it, you know, lavender grows in the south of France. It flourishes there, but that's pretty dry territory. Mm-hmm. Your herbs are going to taste like nothing on earth because I believe the more you stress herbs, the better the flavor.
Good.
Yeah. But now if you want to water like crazy, are you talking about Are we sort of talking about what food plants you can grow in a pot?
Please.
Okay, I haven't had my gardening hat on in several years.
I know.
No, but I did this one year, because one year I had real problems with my back, and we just put sort of trestle tables out on the back lawn and put big pots on them, and I could stand up and grow stuff.
Sure.
You know what it came down to? Anything that made a small bush.
Okay.
Anything that made a small bush. So, for instance, forget the squash family, because boy, they love to sprawl. But for instance, tomatoes, and there's these wonderful little tomatoes that are out now, you know, current tomatoes and that kind of thing. You will get so many little tomatoes on this plant, and you can have everybody sit out there and just pop them into their mouth right from the plant.
That's exactly what I'm looking for.
Think peppers. You know, think bush beans, and you can do all kinds of beans that are, as long as they're bush beans, long as they're bush beans. And you know, there's a whole world of those, from string beans to beans you dry. And you know, beans you in quote dry, beans that you would remove the pod and eat, they're fabulous cooked fresh. Unbelievable. I mean, you could do stuff like fava beans, for goodness sakes. They get a little big, but, you know, if you have a large enough pot.
Sure.
So if it's a bush, as you go through the seed catalogs, just look. If it is a bush, you can grow it in a pot.
Good. Very good advice. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's the basic rule of thumb. And boy, is this going to be a great summer for you.
I cannot wait.
Hey, good luck in the new home.
Okay, thank you very much, Liz.
You take care, Scott.
You too.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252. A philosophical moment. In this era of reality TV, political spin, image is all. Now, think about this. The jeans you wear, the wine you sip, and the mint that you suck. Well, to get one angle on this piercing issue of mints, we have Vogue magazine's Robert Sullivan on the phone. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So why has the mint, of all things, become status?
In part, I would argue, because of what you said, image just continues to go into our life, every aspect of our life, and now to the things that we, to use the word you use, suck. So we are with good-looking things to suck.
And appearance is a big issue here?
Well, yeah. One thing I love about design in everyday life is somebody probably had a reason or an idea, and also there's a history to the reason and the idea in a lot of the things we're touching and eating and here again, sucking on. So with the mints and gums that we're looking at now, their shape is determined, you know, by long ago lozenges that were made to control gas, you know, gastric episodes.
Oh, how charming.
Comes from gas. I love that, too. That's just incredible. But yeah, so Altoids kind of kicked it off a long time ago.
Now, am I hopelessly out of sync with my tin of Altoids these days?
You know, I'm just dipping into the area of mint expertise here. I can't say that I'm the absolute arbiter on mint style, but I think you're looking good with the Altoids tin. But what's exciting about the Altoids tin is that, you know, it's an old thing that became new and hip again.
Yeah, well, that's one of the charms of it, aside from the fact that you can taste nothing after you've had it in your mouth.
That's right. Knocks you out. But now that, of course, you know, we're like bad mint addicts as a society, as a group, because now people are looking for the mintier and mintier mints, or as my young daughter calls them, spicier and spicier mints. So that you've had these British mints that you almost have to be over 18 to use.
Well, what is the latest mint of the moment?
Well, I guess if you're a real mint cultist, then you're going to probably to these British and European mints. Like, I think there's one called XXX, and it's got to do with the charge, not the adult material. But it's fun to see how the mint of the moment has transformed from Altoids, from ye olde mint, again, to be soothing peptically speaking, to the new Altoids thing, or the thing that came out last summer, which is the Altoids version of these Listerine strips, right? You know, these plastic strips.
Oh, those things you put in your mouth. They look like little sheets of plastic.
It's a plastic seeming, right?
I
have trouble with them. But there's how trend pushes a trend in what we eat, because Altoids got people going on really strong mints. And then the Listerine, you know, sort of oral, they call it oral care segment, like dentine and all these gums supposed to make your breath fresh.
Right.
They got panicked and said, oh, my God, Altoids is going to beat us out. So they made these strips, and then Altoids says, oh, my God, we got to make a strip. So now you have a strip, and I have to say, here we end up with what is one of the coolest things around, which is the Altoids mini strip dispenser, which is completely inessential to our daily lives. It makes no difference to us, I would argue. They look like, I describe it as a Barbie, if Ken was painting Barbie's bedroom, and he was using a roller, a paint roller, he would be dipping into this paint roller tray. That is the mint dispenser. It's such a cool design. The lid pops on and off so brilliantly. It's got the history of the metal tin in it, and it's got the sort of trend fanaticness of where we are now and where one marketing department is panicked to the other in it. So it's all there in this little completely inessential thing that you can take to the theater and offer to the person next to you. But my personal favorite mint still forever the best one, the Lifesaver, because you got to work it out. It takes some conversational time. People say, sure, I'll have one. It takes about a half an hour to get it out. Some fall on the ground. It's funny. It relaxes everybody. Lifesavers are the greatest.
And I can make a necklace out of them. Hey, thanks a lot, Robert.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Robert Sullivan writes for Vogue magazine. Oh, and by the way, there's one other thing that Robert turned up. A Dentine Ice focus group found, and I'm quoting this, the person who buys Dentine Ice is a socially active adult who is considered a hot date. All that from your mints. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this invitation from Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, Alice Roosevelt Longworth. She said, if you haven't anything nice to say about anybody, come sit by me. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it right on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.